It's pretty awful. It makes me angry, actually, to think that if something just feels normal and natural, that you feel suspicious of it. Or if you have your own feelings, you have to be suspicious of your own feelings. It's tragic. But you get told that, you get told that thousands of times, and that is your most immediate response. So how do you heal from that? You heal from it just gradually, learning in various ways, learning to trust yourself. And that is the crux of the work that I do.
An ordained minister has decided to give up God for a year.
How the heck do you just up and become atheist after being a pastor?
What I'm most worried about right now is figuring out how I can live openly and honestly.
I am finally free to be me.
I have no idea how to find friends or become a part of a community that's not religious.
What does life look like after church, after religion, after God?
That's it in a nutshell.
This is the Life After God podcast, a conversation on the space between belief and unbelief and beyond, with your host, Ryan Bell.
Welcome back to the Life After God podcast. My name is Ryan Bell, and I'm your host. This is episode 32. Today, I bring you a conversation with Dr. Marlene Winnell. I've been looking forward to this conversation for such a long time because it connects so directly with many of the issues I'm asked about most frequently, namely the psychological repercussions of religion and how we go about recovering from religion or from the negative effects that religion has had on us, so many of us. Marlene has been doing this work for a very long time. She's written a book called Leaving the Fold, which we'll talk a little bit more about in a moment. And I'm just excited to introduce you to her work today. Dr. Winnell is a human development consultant, educator, and writer in the San Francisco Bay Area. Her background includes 28 years of experience in human services in both community and academic settings. She holds a doctorate in human development and family studies from Pennsylvania State University and specializes in communications training for couples. She is the author of the book Leaving the Fold, a guide for former fundamentalists and others leaving their religion. Her services related to recovery from religion can be found at her website, journeyfree.org. And just before we get into my conversation with Dr. Winnell, some exciting news. I'm introducing, finally, the long-awaited, much-anticipated X-Files segment this week. The first installment will air on Friday, April 8, right here on this podcast feed, so I hope you will stay tuned and check that out when it becomes available on Friday. My first guest is Tim Richardson, and in just a moment, I'll share with you a sneak peek of that conversation, which I hope will entice you to listen to the whole thing after it comes out on Friday. In order to avoid missing any new episodes when they come out, I would encourage you to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Also, would you do me a favor and go to Spreaker.com/Life After God and click the button that says follow? That's all you have to do. We currently have 67 followers, which is fantastic. But when we get over 100 followers, we can submit the show to iHeartRadio, and Life After God can get a much wider distribution and listenership. Literally, all you have to do is go to Spreaker.com/Life After God and click follow. The only annoying, potentially annoying thing that might happen is that you'll get an email whenever we update the podcast feed with a new episode, which could be your friendly reminder to check out the new episode of the podcast. So thanks so much for doing that. It's a big help, and you're doing your part to get the podcast out to a wider audience, and it's completely free. If you want to do something to support the show that isn't free, I would encourage you to make a monthly contribution to the show, which is also super easy to do and can be in any, literally any amount. All you need to do is go to patreon.com/lifeaftergod and create a monthly recurring donation of any amount. It could be, for example, the cost of one latte per month. And it would mean the world to our team and our ability to continue creating excellent content for all of our listeners. So if you want to do that, we would be so grateful and appreciate in advance all of your help. Today, special thanks to Ian Gordon. The transition music for X-Files is from his song, The Truth Is Out There, and it's been graciously shared with us for this purpose. So thanks to Ian, and in the show notes, I will include a link to his website where you can hear all of his music and buy his music and support him. So thanks, Ian, for your support of the show and looking forward to future collaboration. This week on The X-Files, I speak to Tim Richardson, a respiratory therapist from Little Rock, Arkansas, and a member of the Life After God community, about his religious and spiritual journey and where he finds himself today.
My name's Tim Richardson. I currently live in Cabot, Arkansas, which is about 30 minutes northeast of Little Rock, if you're looking at a map, and live with my wife and two boys, and love living here. I am a respiratory therapist by occupation, and absolutely love what I do. I got into the medical field and really fell in love with it. Actually, I'm going to continue on and shoot for a physician assistant school soon, so I'm very excited about that. And otherwise, I'm pretty much a nerd. I really enjoy learning new things, and so that pretty well sums me up.
It's sometimes challenging to identify exactly when we started having serious doubts about the faith we were given in our childhood. These changes have a way of sneaking up on a person. But when I asked him, he had a ready response. It had to do with prayer. It wasn't working the way he was told it was supposed to.
Yeah, there's really two points where there's one point where the inkling of doubt kind of started in the back of my mind and I would keep ignoring it. But then there was a later time where it was in my face and I could no longer ignore it. Where the I think what was initially started some serious doubts for me was, you know, as a late teenager, probably in junior, my junior year going into my senior year, you know, up to that point, I have been taking my faith very seriously. Like, I really believed that, you know, if I prayed the fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much, as scripture says. I believe that if I prayed and wanted to know what God's will for my life was, that God was going to answer me, you know. And so I really genuinely believe that with all my heart. So I was coming up with some important life decisions that a high schooler comes up with, where to go to college and, you know, what career path to pursue. And I really believed God was going to lead me into ministry and such. So, at this point in my life, I think I was starting to notice that when I prayed, that sometimes I would answer my own prayers. And I think even any Christian, even, I think, would admit that sometimes they answer their own prayers in their head. But I really wanted to distinguish between me answering my own prayer in my head and God's voice speaking to me, that, like, I really believed He would. So, you know, when dealing with these hard decisions I had to make, I would pray and just really quiet my mind and intentionally, you know, kind of shut my brain down and wait for God to answer. You know, I took this very literally. And of course, it was nothing but disappointment. You know, after that, when I really tried to distinguish between my voice and God's voice, it was nothing but silence, you know. And it didn't cause me not to believe or to seriously doubt, but it bothered me, you know. And I couldn't reconcile my firm belief that God wants to reveal His will to me with the fact that every time I really tried to engage God and find out and, you know, distinguish between my voice and His, that nothing ever really happened. And when the decision, time to make decisions finally came up, it was me that had to make the decision anyway, you know. So going into early adulthood, I was coming to the realization that I was going to have to live my own life and make my own decisions and not wait on some big answer from the sky. And that was kind of the beginning of it.
Tune in this Friday, April 8, for the complete conversation with Tim Richardson. Dr. Marlene Winnell, welcome to the Life After God podcast.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure to get to know your work over the last few years, and it's a pleasure to be able to have you on the program right now. As a bit of background on my end, I don't know how much you know about me, but I left the Seventh-day Adventist Church about three years ago. I was a pastor for 19 years. And wow. So a lot of what I do now, after spending what I called a year without God, I work with individuals who are going through this kind of transition. And I did that almost by accident, because people just started reaching out to me to ask, you know, if they could chat about what they were going through. And so your work really resonates with me, and you are sort of, you have the qualifications and the experience to do the kinds of things that I find myself doing almost, you know, by, like I said, by accident. So it's been a while since I've been interested in talking to you about this sort of thing. And I would love to start by just talking a little bit about your own personal journey, if you wouldn't mind. Where did you begin in religious life, and how did that change for you over the years?
Well, I was born into it. I inherited the religion like many people did. My parents were Assemblies of God missionaries. I was born in Hong Kong and grew up in Taiwan. And while in Taiwan, I also went to a Christian boarding school. And then in the middle of high school, my family relocated to Southern California. And the Jesus movement was in full swing there. So I happily joined in, was one of the Jesus freaks in Southern California.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Calvary Chapel.
Okay.
Yeah. And so the latter part of my adolescence was spent in pretty enthusiastic Christian evangelism as a teenager. And then I went to college, and it was during my college years that I broke away, basically, finding out more about the world. And I'd say it was a combination of pushes and pulls.
Mm.
Pushes being finding out more about the Bible and more about the church history, and also dissatisfactions within the church. So just, you know, becoming more enlightened about what I had been taught, and dissatisfied with what I had been taught. And then pulls being finding out more about the rest of the world and finding out that there were other people that were not crazy or stupid or demented, you know, that could actually have coherent views of the world and could also be happy and weren't evil.
Right, rebellious. Is rebellious one of those words too? Like that these people in the world were supposedly rebellious against God?
Yeah, yeah. And finding out that they were just normal people living their lives, and that there was a lot to offer in the world that wasn't so terrible, and it wasn't all just satanic or Satan being disguised as an angel of light.
Right. You know? Oh, I know those words well. What was one of the? Can you give us an example of a push from your upbringing that just finally was like, this doesn't make sense anymore, or this doesn't fit into the vision of the life I want to have?
Well, inconsistencies in the Bible, a lot of things about the Bible, finding out that it wasn't really the Word of God would be one. Mm-hmm. Another would just be the patriarchy, you know, getting really tired of the way women were treated.
Yeah.
Just a growing feminism that didn't fit with the church. And for example, I was involved with starting a hotline, a 24-hour hotline for people that were in trouble in the community, not just in trouble spiritually, but people that were suicidal or running away from home. And there were a lot of problems in the area. And once we got set up, we had a place, we had phones, and once we got all set up, volunteers and the whole bit, and then when it came to actually staffing the place, the the local church that was giving us our initial funding said that the director had to be a man.
Oh, wow.
And I had done all the work along with this other woman, and we were basically pushed out because, you know, we didn't have the right genitalia. I was pretty upset. I mean, I took a secondary role and I stuck with it, but that was a big light went on at that point.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, that's, and I think there are so many, I actually kind of suspected you might talk about patriarchy, you know, because it's such a defining characteristic of fundamentalism, and it certainly was in my experience as well. I actually, it took me longer because I was benefiting from the patriarchy even when I didn't realize I was. But it was, you know, the Seventh-day Adventist Church is still troubled about whether women can be fully ordained pastors in the movement. And meanwhile, the rest of the evangelical world has moved on to, at least they're struggling over whether gays and lesbians can be a part of the church. But the Adventists are still, you know, wrestling about the rights of women. And it's so ironic because one of the founders of the Seventh-day Adventist Church is a prominent woman who they consider to be a prophet. And it sounds very much like starting up a movement, a couple of women starting up a movement and then being pushed aside. You know, it's almost the exact story of the Seventh-day Adventist Church.
Right, right. And in this case, they brought in a man who had been a Christian for 3 months.
Wow. He was more qualified than you.
Yeah, yeah. But he'd been called of the Lord, you know. And the Lord had called him to that position, so we were supposed to accept that.
Was it in college that you decided to go in the direction of a career in psychology?
Yeah. My first degree was in social ecology, which was at the University of California, Irvine. So I wasn't sure I was going to actually be a psychologist. But later on, I got my doctorate in human development and family studies at Penn State, and then became licensed as a psychologist in addition to that. But I was fascinated with psychology, and actually that was one of the big factors in moving away, because you can't really study psychology without questioning your faith, because psychology just provides a completely different explanation for human behavior. You know, you look at the idea of sin and it just makes no sense.
And also the question of why we believe things is
right.
So clearly, I mean, that was a big thing for me in 2014, just a couple of years ago, when I was examining all of these things. Psychology provided such a, I mean, not an airtight explanation, because it's not that sort of discipline, I guess, but it's such a plausible explanation for, you know, why we believe things that aren't true, or why we hold on to narratives that don't serve us. And I was just like, oh, that's exactly what's happening here.
Right, right.
So did you then, you left the church at some point and still believed in some kind of divine, or how did that evolve for you?
I gradually just gave it up. I started not attending church. Oh, another factor was getting involved in a real human relationship, you know, falling in love. And realizing that I had been pretty much addicted in an affective way to my relationship with God. And I've said before that Jesus was my first lover,
mm-hmm.
you know, my imaginary lover. And then having a real lover somehow makes that much less important. And to have real arms around you and real love changes the whole picture. And so right after college, I got married. And, you know, the need also drops away. The need for this comfort that you get from religion. I think, you know, and I've talked about this in my work, religion serves a certain number of real needs. You know, needs for community, needs for intimacy, needs for meaning in life, a lot of things that are quite real human needs. So if you start getting those needs met elsewhere, it makes it less of an intense kind of draw. So for me, it just gradually, over a period of time, just fell away.
Hmm.
I didn't have a single event. In other words, there wasn't a particular event that made me just suddenly get fed up.
Right. Have you seen the movie Lars and the Real Girl?
Yeah.
I used to do a series of sermons every year at my church about films and sort of make contemporary biblical sort of connections between narrative themes in film. And this is one of the films we did one year. And I couldn't help but, I didn't say this in the sermon, but in my mind, I'm like, gosh, this is like having a relationship with God. You know, it's this blow-up doll, except in the case of the blow-up doll, you actually have the blow-up doll, you know, it's... But it just made me think of it again when you were talking about having an imaginary lover.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Did you identify as an atheist at some point along that way? Did you become comfortable with that sort of description of yourself? And is that something you think of yourself as today?
Well, the word is so loaded mm-hmm. that I don't really use it because I think that the way that people think of it, it lacks spirituality for a lot of people, and so I don't use it. But I don't believe in an entity that's up in the sky somewhere.
Right.
I do subscribe to a different kind of spirituality, and so I would say that I'm a spiritual person, but no, I don't believe in God.
And when you say spiritual, do you mean, well, what do you mean?
Well, I think that I believe in having an appreciation for wonder and awe and having connection, in appreciating transcendence, and also the integrity of how I live. I think those are all aspects of spirituality. I meditate.
Hmm.
Having a spiritual practice.
Yeah, I think that's so good. I think those things can be called spirituality. In fact, the renowned atheist Sam Harris a couple years ago wrote a book called Waking Up, you may have seen, and he talks about spirituality and meditation. And so yeah, I thought if Sam Harris can have a spiritual life, then I suppose any atheist can have a spiritual life.
Yeah, I've appreciated that book.
Yeah. So you, in 1993, first wrote this book, Leaving the Fold.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just leaving Bible college, Fundamentalist Bible College in 94, and starting on my slow evolution towards becoming a more liberal Christian and then finally leaving the fold myself. So I was, as I was reading your book, I was trying to imagine where I was in 1993. It was just, it's almost unimaginable. I was wrestling with whether it was okay to give my then girlfriend an engagement ring because that was jewelry and the Seventh-day Adventist Church was against wearing jewelry. We were having debates on campus about whether women could wear pants. I was agonizing over whether it was okay to eat meat or not because as it wasn't just a principle of health or ecology, but actual spiritual rightness or wrongness. So that was my world in 1993. So I'm reading this book and it reads like you wrote it yesterday. And I'm thinking, my goodness, this so much, it's 23 years ago.
Yeah.
How much you must have seen change and develop in that time. And yet the needs are still the same, it seems like.
Yeah, I know. It's really interesting. And last year, it sold as much as ever.
Really?
Yeah. And I mean, people are leaving religion more than ever.
That's true.
So the issues are the same. The issues, the religious problems have been around for a long, long time. You know, I mean, fundamentalism is, for one thing, extremely out of date, right?
Yeah.
So the issues that people are grappling with are pretty ancient. So discussing them, I mean, that's one of the issues that people have when they come out of the faith is there's this Rip Van Winkle effect. waking up to being in the world. I just got through writing a chapter for a book about the struggle with becoming secular as a cross-cultural process.
Oh man, I relate to that so much, because when I sort of postulated to much criticism that I would spend a year as being an atheist or trying on atheism, and I put trying on in quotes because I kind of had a sense that you don't just try on atheism like a pair of pants, but what I meant was that I was going to engage in what I then called a cross-cultural type of experience, where I would enter a community or a way of thinking that was foreign to me, the way I would try to learn, go to Nicaragua and try to learn Spanish.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah. That's great that you did that.
Yeah. So that was my project in 2014. I had been kicked out of my church. I was a pastor. And I think because I was a pastor, I had some autonomy in leading my congregation the way I wanted to, even though I was still tethered to this fundamentalist denomination that paid my salary and got in frequent trouble. And it was really the LGBT movement for equality, especially in response to Proposition 8 in California, that pushed me and some others over the edge. But we tried to remain within the system and reform it, because that was our commitment. And eventually the denomination, for a variety of reasons, you know, said I wasn't qualified to be a Seventh-day Adventist pastor anymore. And I like to say I was the last one to find out, because they were right and I was in denial about it. And yeah. But I really felt like the church that I was leading was helping a lot of people just go on this spiritual journey that we talk about. And I could do more good from the inside than outside. And I had frequently said I would stay as long as they would have me. And then when they wouldn't have me anymore, I would go, which is what ended up happening. And that was early 2013. And then in 2014, at sort of at the end of my spiritual existential rope, I said, well, I'm just going to give in to what seems logical at this moment, which is that there's no God, even though I really, really wanted there to be a God. And I just went on this sort of mental and practical exercise of trying on atheism. And it really fit. I mean, it really made a lot more sense of the world than the narratives that I had been given.
Uh-huh. Was that scary to try out?
Oh, yeah. It's fascinating to read your book, because I wish I had read it at the beginning of my journey. But it's so interesting, because it was a combination of scary and relief. Like, yeah. I one day I was just relieved. The sun seemed to be shining brighter. The sky seemed bluer. I didn't have these artificial constraints placed on me that didn't seem natural to me. But then I was taught not to believe that what felt natural to me was right. In fact, I was taught to believe that what felt natural to me was wrong, and I shouldn't trust it. And so it was that sense of almost like growing up that I maybe never did. Like I just said, oh, I have my own mind. I have my own thoughts. I can trust them. I can, you know, run with my own sense of appreciation of the world. And then it would turn around and be really scary, because I would realize it was sort of like looking over your shoulder and expecting your dad to be holding the back of your bicycle as you're, and there's no dad like holding your bicycle. You realize you're just riding this bicycle by yourself, and you're like, oh shit, what if I lose control of the bike? And so that kind of fear was there as well.
Wow, what a great analogy.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's that feeling of like, toward the end of my experience, I did not have this robust so-called relationship with God. You know, I didn't chat with God every day like I did when I was younger. And I felt bad about that, but I just figured that I was wrong about that sense of, you know, evangelical concept of having a personal relationship with God. But it clung to me in ways I didn't recognize, and I realized that whenever I was in a real pinch, I had this sort of calm sense of that everything was going to be okay. Mm-hmm. And that calm sense of everything being okay came from, you know, there's someone that's in charge of the universe.
Yeah.
Even if I didn't have a personal relationship with this person necessarily, or just it wasn't as robust as it used to be, just the same way that a relationship with a parent changes over time. Like, you know, one day it's mommy and 10 years later it's mom. And next time it's like, oh, I haven't talked to her in 3 months. I should probably give her a call. So, you know, it was that kind of thing. And then becoming an atheist was really scary in the sense that when I felt like things might not turn out okay, I had to face the fact that they might not, you know, it might just be, you know, bad stuff just happens.
So then you're riding your bicycle by yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. And I realized after a little while that I can do it.
And how does that feel?
It's freeing. Yeah, it's freeing. Did we just switch into therapy mode here? I feel like I'm doing the talking now and you're asking the questions.
I'm just really loving your description.
Yeah, that bicycle analogy just actually came to me in this moment. I don't think I've used that before. There was a popular song that came. It was popular in I think 2013 and 14, called "Say Something," and it's about a breakup, human relationship, but it fits so well for my personal relationship with God, where the singer says, "Say something, I'm giving up on you." And so that was another kind of sense of I had been holding on for so long in a relationship in which one partner wasn't pulling his weight. So I finally let go.
You know, I just recently this man joined our support group. We have this online support group that has conference calls. And this guy's a lawyer, and it was a similar kind of story where, as an experiment, he decided that he would test out his faith as a placebo. He decided he would think of it as a placebo effect, and try out thinking about it that way. And if God and his faith was simply a placebo, what would it be like to treat it like that? Would it be any different if it wasn't true? Would his life be any different? And he found out that it wasn't. So he gave it up.
Yeah, that was one of my, you know, I postulated that as well, that if I stop going to church and I stop praying, which I wasn't doing a ton of anyway, and if I stop reading the Bible and reading a bunch of religious books and trying to, you know, make my life fit into that story, if Christianity is what I've been saying and others have been saying it is, then my life should change quite dramatically by stopping doing those things. Like, I should feel less connected, less whole. But I didn't. I felt, in some sense, I felt more whole. And then in other sense, I felt scared because I was letting go of something. But yeah, it didn't. You know, the ceiling didn't come crashing down on me. I didn't, you know, I there were moments of existential despair, but I tend to be a little melancholy anyway. I'm sort of a fan of the existentialist, you know, so that's just dispositionally the way I approach the world sometimes. But yeah, it didn't change that much.
Yeah, interesting.
Is that so? In your, one of the things you talk about in your book that's so interesting to me, and I have only... The problem with being a generalist and not being an expert with the proper education for, you know, in psychology and so forth, is that I have these guesses about things or these hunches that often turn out to be supported by the evidence. But I just wondered, you write about not being able to, or being taught by fundamentalism or various versions of conservative Christianity, to not be able to think for yourself and the damage that that does to a person. What kind of research is out there about a person's, I mean, it's when you step back and look at it, it's shocking that a person could agree to essentially not think for themselves. Like, how could you be talked into that? And it happens at a very young age, I realize, but people also agree to it as adults. What's going on in that, and how do people learn to recover their own mind about the world and their own life?
Well, the first part of your question, how do people get taught and how do they agree to that? They get taught by getting told the same thing thousands of times. There are so many verses in the Bible like that that get quoted. I think one of the worst verses, the hardest The heart is wicked and deceitful above all things. I can't.
And desperately wicked. It goes on to say desperately wicked.
Desperately wicked. Yeah. Which isn't directly about thinking for yourself, but basically what comes from you is wrong and wicked. Mm. And in other words, you can't trust yourself. A fool says in his heart, there's no God. You're just told that you're a fool and you can't think for yourself. You can't trust your own heart. And what you said a little bit ago, that if something feels natural, then it must be wrong. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty awful. It makes me angry, actually, you know, to think that if something just feels normal and natural, that you feel suspicious of it. Or if you have your own feelings, you have to be suspicious of your own feelings. It's tragic. But you get told that, you get told that thousands of times, and that is your most immediate response. So how do you heal from that? You heal from it just gradually, learning in various ways, learning to trust yourself. And that is the crux of the work that I do. Hmm. I tell people at the front end that the essence of the healing work that we're going to do is learning to trust yourself. And that can take all different forms.
Yeah, I remember the first time I was at a seminar on leadership, but it was a very kind of spirituality of leadership type of conference or a seminar that I was taking. And there was a little bit of woo involved in this as I look back on it. But I remember the person talking, the part that struck me was that the speaker was talking about intuition and that there is a deep level of intuition in excellent leadership, that most really good leaders have learned to trust their gut. And they also supplement that, of course, with evidence and, you know, good analysis of the business or whatever it is they're doing. But then they also have like a gut feeling. And then I read Malcolm Gladwell's book, Blink, in which he talks about, you know, this concept of thin slicing, and he has an illustration in there about hiring, and he's, you know, talks about how studies have shown that people usually know within a few seconds if they are going to hire the person or not, even though of course they go through all the steps of vetting the person's qualifications and so forth. And I remember thinking that this intuition was not trustworthy, right? And it is, and at some level it's not, and Gladwell talks about that, and others have talked about that. And so I went up to the speaker afterwards, and I said, you know, this intuition you keep talking about, like, I don't know if I can trust it, and then he got kind of spiritual on me, and he said, well, when you pray, like, what happens? And I said, well, you know, I talk to God, and does God respond? I said, yeah, sort of. How does God respond to you? Well, I get this feeling or this sense of, you know, what I should do. And he's like, that's your, what's another secular word for that feeling? And he's like, I said, oh, intuition. So, you know, all along I was being taught to use my intuition, but only if it conformed to a sense of what God was saying. And, yeah. And I remember thinking, oh, I have this intuition. I have this sense of intuition about the world that I'm smart. I have wisdom. And it was an amazing awakening. I was still a pastor. I was still a Christian at that time. But I remember this kind of odd discovery that I had wisdom.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of exciting, too.
It is, yeah. And we'd started using that at my church. And we would do these things, sort of a Native American take, a spinoff, probably a cultural appropriation from a Native American type of practice of a wisdom circle, where everybody in the circle just share on a particular topic, just shares a bit of their wisdom, and no one gets to contradict them. They can only share their wisdom, you know, and it was powerful in the way that our church sort of took a turn at that point, and we started trusting one another a bit more.
I had a exercise that I did just to kind of prove this point at a retreat. I had people pair off, stand up and pair off with other people. We're just like, it was a cocktail party or something.
Right.
And for just 2 minutes at a time, you would talk to one other person, and I would throw out a topic, and you were supposed to just pontificate about this topic to this other person about what you think about it, and show that you have opinions about it, that you know something about it, and just from your own wisdom. So, like, I would say friendship, and then you were supposed to talk about what you think good friendship is, and just talk. And then I'd throw out another topic, and for, you know, get with somebody else, and then, you know, listen to somebody else talk about good parenting, and then, you know, say what you think about that. And when we were done, everybody was just completely flabbergasted that they actually had a lot of really good thoughts about a lot of things, because they were so convinced, they had been so convinced that they didn't know anything.
Wow, what a terrible thing to do to someone, to convince them of their stupidity in some way. It's just, I still struggle with it, to be honest with you. I still, you know, I'll do something or something will happen that's totally outside of my control, and I'll say to myself, sometimes out loud, I'm so stupid, you know, or I'm so, you know, and I don't know how much of that's just my, you know, childhood and my upbringing and other things that happened to me, and how much of that's, you know, directly related to religion. It's probably impossible to parse those things out completely, but it sticks with people, I guess, is my point. That sense of not being capable of navigating the world on your own is really pernicious.
Yeah.
It's like a weed with deep roots.
It's nice to find out it's not true, and you do have loads of inner wisdom.
Yeah, absolutely. My partner and I have been reading a little bit, her more than me, but I've joined her a few times in some reading that we've been doing about self-compassion and the way it's sort of distinct from self-esteem and kind of Buddhist. You mentioned meditation a moment ago, a kind of mindfulness and the kind of self-compassion that's inherent in this practice of mindfulness. Would you comment on that from your experience? It sounds like that might be part of your personal experience as well as your practice.
It's hugely important to have loving kindness for yourself, because I'd say the two most pernicious doctrines that you get taught in fundamentalist Christianity are the original sin idea of being basically bad and hellfire. I call them the horror and the terror. You're supposed to be horrified self and terrified about what can happen. So those two things are in my experience, my 20 years of experience in working with people, the two things that are the hardest to weed out later on. People, you know, wake up with nightmares about being in hell, or they're also fearful of the world. So fear and anxiety are really hard. But then self-loathing is really hard too. So to learn to have kindness and love for yourself, which, as you said, is different from self-esteem, but just genuine love and care for yourself. And, you know, to find ways of doing that in any way possible, in the way that I help people do it, I use metaphor and symbolism, and I find the inner child metaphor to be hugely helpful, because people can grasp it. And also the inner adult, because it's the relationship between the adult and child that makes it possible to grasp a way of relating to self. And it's okay to have parts of self. It's not a schizophrenic thing. It's a method of actually talking to yourself and comforting yourself. Self-soothing is something that we never learned, you know, in the religious framework. We outsourced it to God. You know,
Right.
We have to reclaim that and learn how to soothe ourselves and love ourselves. So that's a hugely important thing.
Yeah, I think that process just takes time, I think. And when people leave religion, especially fundamentalist religion as adults, I mean, I think the initial feeling of freedom comes rather quickly. And then there's this long journey of recovery that I think a lot of people that I talk to are a little impatient about it. They want to feel better, and yet they still have these things that haunt them about what if I'm wrong, or like you said, hellfire sort of hanging in over their shoulder, like this threatening possibility, and the loss of relationships that these changes in belief entail, and people are in anguish about it, and I think they're a little impatient for it to get better quickly. But in your experience, does it just take time as well for people to consistently instill new mental habits? And are there any ways for people to kind of hasten the process of healing?
It takes time, but I think you can hasten it. Yeah. That's why what I was saying about developing this relationship with yourself, with some of the processes, some of the cognitive restructuring processes, and some of this nurturing of self and the adult and child relationship, I think hastens the process quite a bit. And also building up your strengths so that you understand yourself better and can build on who you want to be instead of who you think you were before, you know, to develop that sense of self. That's the other thing that is important to understand about the way that you were raised. You weren't really supposed to develop a sense of self, an identity. You know, you were supposed to be empty. You're supposed to empty yourself and not, I mean, if you did something that was bad, it was your own fault. If you did something that was good, it was God working through you.
You just never get a break.
Right. And so you were never supposed to have any of these, any good qualities that were yours.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's so familiar to me.
So when you get out, you know, you're free to go ahead and develop who you are. And that's kind of exciting. And so, you know, go ahead and do that.
Right. Yeah. Oh, that's great. No, I think that's so so meaningful to me. And I know just from some correspondence with folks that listen to the podcast that it'll be really meaningful to them as well. Sometimes, you know, it's weird how we really don't need permission, because we're autonomous individuals. We don't need anyone else's permission really to do anything legal. But permission can sometimes be really helpful. Like someone who's been coaching and counseling people for 20 years says, you know, this is okay for you to feel this way. And you go, oh, wow, that's great. I kind of thought it was okay, but it's so nice to hear from someone who's, you know, been doing this for a while that it's okay. And now I feel much better. You know, even just that little bit of nudge out of the nest, you know, to say, you can fly. It's okay. Give it a shot.
The other thing that's really nice is that you can relate to anybody you want. You don't have to consider people sheep and goats anymore, saved and unsaved. Mm. You can have friends of any stripe, you know?
Yeah.
You don't have to work at converting people. You can just relate to the rest of the world. What I say sometimes in my talks, I say, welcome home.
Wow.
This is your world. This is your planet. Join the human race. If you want, you can get involved. You can be an environmentalist if you like. You can involve yourself with the arts, with politics, whatever you like. Welcome home.
Oh, that's so beautiful. And I feel like, too, the thing, a sort of a corollary for me, and I wonder what you think of this, is I feel less like I need to agree with everything a person says to appreciate them as a person. So I have more friends now that there's like this 20-25% of them that I just don't get and I don't relate to very well, or even might think it's a little weird or wrong. Not wrong in the really moral sense, but just sort of like weird. But I'm like, that's just who they are, you know, it's okay. And I don't have to be just like them and they don't have to be just like me. I can love and appreciate them and also say there's this percentage of them that I don't relate to.
Right.
And you don't
have to be judgmental.
Yeah, that's it. People are living their own lives.
Although there is something to having leftovers, you know, sometimes you can give up all the doctrines and still have some of the habits, like being judgmental,
right?
Or like having black and white thinking, or you can do these kinds of things. My friend Valerie Tirico calls it mental hygiene. And sometimes that needs a little cleaning up.
Yes, for sure. Yeah, there's a lot of these hang-ups that linger on, for sure. Well, I had, as we sort of run out of time here, I wanted you to mention the anything that's upcoming that you're working on, whether you are writing another book, or I know you have a conference that you're participating in coming up, and... What's next up for you? What are you working on that's making you excited these days?
Well, I don't have any book coming up. I just have this conference in Minneapolis. It's called Recovering from Religion, April 6 to 9. And then another retreat in July. You can find out about these things, about the retreats, and about our ongoing support group by going to journeyfree.org, and any kind of counseling as well.
And do you do this type of counseling over sort of over technology like Skype or the phone, or do you need to be sort of in proximity?
I have an office in Oakland, but most of it is over Skype, so I can see people wherever they are.
That's awesome. Yeah. So if folks are listening and want to connect with you and do some work around these issues, do you have a staff that works with you too, or are you pretty much a solo practice?
At this stage, I'm a solo practice. I also do consulting with other therapists, though, if other therapists have a client that they have that is going through this kind of thing and they want to consult about it. I've done that.
Oh, that's excellent. Well, we live in this world that is increasingly dangerous. I mean, you said a minute ago toward the beginning of our conversation that that fundamentalism and the problems of fundamentalism are very old, and yet mm-hmm. they're also very tenacious. You know, just when you think that fundamentalism might be finally succumbing to modernity and enlightenment, it reasserts itself, you know, as a counter movement. And, you know, we saw that, I think, in the 70s and 80s when people predicted that, you know, science would prevail and religion of this, especially of this sort, would fade away. And now we're faced with a new resurgence. Even as recently as last week, we saw the results of a kind of religious and political fundamentalism married to one another. And it's a scary world that we live in at times. And I don't know what we can all do on an individual level about that, but certainly breaking free of some of these chains individually has to contribute societally to a healthier world, I have to think.
Well, if nothing else, people need to be able to think, you know, and what we were saying before about all the injunctions in the religion to not think for ourselves is very, very dangerous. Very, very dangerous. I mean, we have an election going on, and people really honestly need to have their values straight, and they need to be able to think clearly in order to make rational decisions.
Yeah, these individual matters have larger societal repercussions, and I think that's really wise advice as we continue to trudge on in this very weird primary season and into the general election. It's just it's a strange time that we live in, and it's like you say, it's certainly high time for us to be sharp, critical thinkers. No matter what our supernatural hunches may be, we still need to be able to operate on the ground in the real world in a critical way,
and not do things out of fear.
Yeah, yes, fear. I mean, we didn't touch on that. I mean, it's been implicit, I think, in everything we've been saying, but these politicians really employ that emotion to manipulate the masses, and how manipulable we can sometimes be.
Yeah.
Give away our freedoms and our autonomy. Marlene Winnell, thank you so much for being on the show. I know it's been a real pleasure for me. I hope people will go and check out your book, Leaving the Fold, a guide for former fundamentalists and others leaving their religion. It's been updated recently, and it's, like I said, I read it, and it's just so indicative and reflective of my journey, and I know it'll continue to be helpful for thousands of others as they, more and more people, as you say, leave religion and forge out on their own. So thank you for taking this time with us, and best wishes in all of your upcoming endeavors.
Well, thank you for having me on. It was a pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Marlene and the sneak preview of X-Files. Don't forget to check back on Friday and listen to the complete conversation with my friend Tim Richardson. If you haven't been able to keep up with the podcast, which I completely understand, I have many friends who are podcasters, and I embarrassingly confess to them quite frequently that I'm not able to keep up with all their episodes. So if that's happened to you, no problem. But just a couple of highlights that you might want to know about. 2 episodes ago, episode 30 with Bart Ehrman is already the number 10 most listened to podcast on this show. So if you haven't heard that one yet, be sure you go back and check it out. It's quite popular. And Bart Ehrman is a fantastic biblical scholar that has shed so much light on the Bible and what it is and what it isn't, and what we can know about the person of Jesus. So check out episode 30 with Bart Ehrman. Also, last week's conversation with Brandon Phibbs is rapidly becoming one of the most popular shows. We talked about his deconversion, as well as his work on the TV show Cosmos, and the brand new TV show that's airing on National Geographic Channel called The Story of God with Morgan Freeman. And that's just begun airing this week, and I hope you'll check out the TV show as well as my conversation with Brandon Phibbs. Next week on the show, and again, I'm reluctant to say next week on the show because every time I do that, it changes and I have to insert something else. But as far as I know right now, next week on the show is my conversation, which I just recorded yesterday with my friend Zeke Pystrup. He is a local LA resident living in Venice, California, and he is a filmmaker who's made a number of films, but relevant to our conversation is his film Apocalypse Later, Harold Camping versus the End of the World, which came out in 2014, right as I was beginning my year without God. Harold Camping is famous for having made multiple predictions of the end of the world. And in 2013, he predicted on May 21st that the world would experience God's final judgment. Of course, we are all still here, so Harold was wrong again about that. But I talked to Zeke about his experience hanging out with Mr. Camping in the final days of the world's history, and what it was like to interact with him, and what he thinks is the problem with these sorts of apocalyptic religions, of which Christianity is one. So I hope you'll check that out next week. Thanks again to Ian Gordon, who provided this very cool music for the development of the X-Files segment. Looking forward to future collaborations with Mr. Gordon and his music. As always, my name is Ryan Bell, And this has been the Life After God podcast.